tsunami's back, bitches.
Took you long enough.
This has been an experience we will never forget.
This ain't no time to go all mushy.
Don't lecture me. I've waited long enough.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 431 of the Tsunami Escape Podcast. I'm C. Kohler, and with me tonight is Seda.
Hello.
And Crocodile.
Hello.
All right, let's start out with the news. And the big news item this week comes courtesy of the Tsunami Faithful crew. Sketch got to interview Jason DeMarco, who's kind of been out of the loop when it comes to Tsunami news for a while since he took a break from social media. And he answered a ton of questions. Now, I haven't listened to the actual interview, but I figured we just go over some of the things that he talked about. And the one I want to mention right out of the gate, which, I mean, we kind of understood this, but, you know, he kind of goes into more detail about his involvement with Tsunami or maybe lack thereof. He's a full-time WP employee now. He consults with Adult Swim, but he's not involved in the day-to-day anymore.
So DeMarco, I'm sure from his history, has connections both in the States and in Japan to like connect people to the right, to other people, get things rolling. I think Croc mentioned in his notes, like he sometimes will do like rubber stamping on like some decisions, but yeah, it seems like more day-to-day stuff. He really kind of is hands off and leaves that to other people. Although Crocodile also mentioned in his write-up that according to DeMarco, a lot of the people who were there when Tsunami was rebooted, you know, 13 years ago or whenever, and also even some from the original days are still there. So,
yeah,
it's kind of surprising that, you know, that longevity.
I kind of was wondering about Gil too. And I think your notes, Croc, here say also that I think Gil isn't as involved anymore either, because they were talking something about pre-flight.
So no, I think you mentioned Gil a few times. I think Gil is still there, but I think he mentioned regards to pre-flight. That's probably not going to be something that happens until either he or Gil retires, just because they don't really have the time and the resources to do that. So, like, yeah, that's pretty much. Yeah, he mentions Gil a few times, but like, I thought the when he mentioned in regards to what might happen to if pre-flight would ever return, because it was clearly something that people had been asking about, and it was something he was asked about. I specifically wrote about Gil there, but he name dropped Gil a few times. So my understanding is that Gil still had Adult Swim and whatnot.
The thing with Gil has never been super active on social media. He had like a Twitter account, but barely used it. We're talking like one tweet every other year or something like that. And I doubt he's made a Blue Sky account or anywhere else. So he's kind of off the grid, you know, good for him, but less, you know, insight, I guess, like publicly that we can know, like decisions or, you know, answers or, you know, anything, impressions. So unlike DeMarco, who when he was on social media was, you know, would oftentimes do Q&As or answer questions or sometimes complain.
Yeah.
But that does mean that we are a little bit more blind in terms of like,
oh, yeah, you know,
the state of things in terms of, what is their plan? Do they have anything, you know, that, you know, in store or whatever? Obviously we get some announcements here and there, and right now the block is doing okay, it seems. But yeah, just a little bit less of that, you know, open door, you know, I guess, communication.
I would say it was kind of more tendentially touched upon an interview rather than directly asked. Like obviously the subject pre-flight came about, but I feel like they could have maybe pressed a little harder in terms of like, but though I guess DeMarco not being there, it's not really his maybe job to do so much, but like he's kind of said that like he thought it was good for him to be kind of more of a face for Tsunami and kind of a source of information back when he was kind of more directly involved. But he's obviously said he like had to leave social media for his mental health, and he just feels he's been happier that way, that he can still find most or all the news he needs to find without social media. So he's generally happy to be off of there. But he was like, he did think it was useful for him to have that role to be kind of like that front man or the answer man and whatnot. But yeah, so I would say the subject of communication was kind of more tangentially touched upon, but I would say that's probably maybe one of the bigger issues with current dynamics because we often don't know what's going on. And they're obviously not obligated to tell us, but as even kind of DeMarco discusses.
Yeah, I think we were spoiled in the past of being able to have that two-way communication. And now we're just sort of like, people are still operating Toonami, but we just don't know anything until they air it. And that's kind of the only difference, but it is unfortunate. I think because, like I said, we got used to being able to know things in advance through social media and so forth.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they do post like, you know, schedule changes and stuff like a week or more in advance.
Yeah. They're fairly active on Facebook, even if it's more just formal, not necessarily formal, but like, here's the schedule, here's a promo type of thing.
One thing he also talked about was the interesting history of Lazarus, where that show actually was originally intended for Max, but it got canceled. So Adult Swim Toonami actually came in and swooped it up and saved the show. I did not know that. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, I wonder how long Lazarus, like, obviously we all know that animation takes forever. Like, but just curious, like, when would this have to have been greenlit? Like years and years and years ago.
I guess, do we remember when it was first announced to us? Obviously, it would have already been in development for a while before it got announced to us. But do you guys remember when it was announced?
I don't. It was like a year before we got it, though, right?
A year?
At least.
Okay, I'm just trying.
It seems like it was like a year.
Okay. Well, I mean, obviously, it's not going to be like Uzumaki, which I think was announced 4 years before we got it. But of course, that has had a super troubled development. Even kind of Marcos asked about it and it was pretty much said, I can't say anything. Clearly, he's under NDA, but it sounds like it was a super mess, as we speculated.
It looks like it was announced in July of 2023. So almost 2 years ago. And it had to be in production for years before that point. So let's just say roughly 5 years, probably. Like five years ago from now was when it was probably greenlit. Like to get things rolling. I'm being rough, you know. I mean,
it seems reasonable, though. Yeah.
I'm curious how much of its development coincided with COVID. Might have been the tail end of that. But
could have been. Yeah. No doubt that had some effect on it. Mm-hmm. Other bits of news here. Ninja Kamui's international rollout came out slow, so it actually ended up getting a lot of pirating done on that show. And DeMarco even hypothesized that that might have actually been a factor in the Crunchyroll Awards as far as distribution goes.
Yeah, I mean, as we said, it ended up being a surprise mega hit.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in here. Anything else, Crocodile, you think's worth mentioning here before we move on?
Well, I think one big thing I want to mention is that he was pretty straightforward that like Lazarus basically hit. And that Watanabe was very happy with reception. It's a big contrast with, I think we heard about this before, but how Space Dandy basically flopped previously, especially Japan.
Yeah.
Like it seems now that, you know, everyone's kind of come around to it, but it flopped pretty hard when it first released. That seemed to have really affected Watanabe. And it's like, makes it very unlikely there will be a sequel, though DeMarco was open to it. Apparently, there's some misconception that DeMarco was the one who was preventing more Space Dandy from being made. I don't know where that came from. I think it was roughing some article, but I had never seen an article. But I definitely think one of the bigger things here is that, by all the metrics, I guess that matter, Lazarus so far is a hit. We'll see if the ending actually leaves room for a sequel. I'm skeptical it will, given how things are headed. But, like, you know.
No, I don't think so, because as we'll talk about later, the actual promo for the final episode says series finale. It doesn't say season.
Yeah, that's actually rare for Marvel to have, they always say season finale regardless if there's ever more seasons, but this is actually pretty confident. That's true.
And as far as the Space Dandy thing you said earlier, we kind of knew from him before about that Watanabe not being hot on Space Dandy, but DeMarco did go on to say that, like, if he could ever convince him to do more of it, he would jump at the opportunity.
Yeah. So, like, it sounds like given the performance of Lazarus, I think there's high likelihood that more Watanabe shows will show up in the future. Obviously, DeMarco can't make any promises. I mean, no one can, but the way, given the what he revealed, there was definitely conversations with Watanabe about other projects. While Lazarus was supposed to be something else, they were trying to get the rights for it, and it fell through, and then Lazarus became Lazarus. So there's like clearly other ideas that Watanabe has that he definitely wants to make. And so it's clear, you know, obviously DeMarco was open to it, and it's just a matter of getting the funding and all that sort of stuff. It was actually a pretty lengthy discussion in terms of what DeMarco's job is and what the job producer is. Maybe that's best left for people to actually listen to the episode, but I thought it was a pretty thorough kind of discussion of, like, what does DeMarco do and how does he get things done? And, you know, going from basically cradle to airing, I thought it was a pretty fascinating process.
Yeah, I think the interesting bit there you just said, though, about the Watanabe connection. I mean, going through your notes, it seems like there's real possibilities of more shows from him.
Yeah, definitely. Especially given that, you know, Lazarus was did well. So that's for sure. One thing I think that we probably speculated, but I think it was helpful to have DeMarco confirm, is that, and even give a little more insight in, is that obviously Konami having difficulty getting shows is often because of, like, outside issues, rights and the IP holders being problematic. It's not that, you know, the people working at Konami don't know what they're doing necessarily, also they're human, but, you know, they generally know what they're doing or know what the hot shows are. But it's just like, it's hard to outbid people like Netflix and Hulu and so on and so forth. But he also mentioned something pretty interesting, that because they're a broadcast network, they have certain considerations that something like Crunchyroll does not. So, like, they need to get approving for advertising and marketing and so on and so forth in a way that Crunchyroll does not, and that makes it a little more difficult. So it seems that, like, right holders in Japan, they're definitely more stringent of how to use their rights, you know, to prevent kind of robotechs in the future. But also, like, though those right holders in Japan respect Toonami, because they're more stringent about how they maintain the rights to their properties, because they're just more considerations about how Toonami works than Crunchyroll does, sometimes it makes things more difficult.
There's a bunch more information in this interview. It's all really worth listening to. If you're interested in listening to it, you can go to the Toonami Faithful YouTube channel, and you'll see it there. It's exclusive number 61, Catching Up with Jason DeMarco. Again, it's hosted by Sketch and Kuro from the Toonami Faithful podcast. So go check it out. It's really worth listening to. A lot of great Toonami information there. All right, well, let's move on to the block, and let's talk about Lazarus. Lazarus episode 12, Close to the Edge, the penultimate episode of the series. And we begin with Alane waking up in Popcorn Wizard's bus, where we learn that her name is actually Lynn. And while this is going on, we also see that Doug is also waking up in some kind of medical facility somewhere. We see a scene with Abel where he's discussing with his sort of his assistant named Elizabeth, about how he thinks this assassin, which we learn his name is Soryu, may be a key factor in the, quote, case. Now, I don't know what he's talking about there when he talks about the case, but it has something to do with everything that's happening, I guess. Axel wakes up from a recurring dream in the hospital, where he's apparently always being rescued by an angel. And that's when, of course, he opens his eyes and sees Chris standing there. We learn that this is that same hospital from a few episodes ago, the sort of exclusive one. We even see that doctor, I think. Yeah, the one that Leland helped them with. Yeah, and I think that same doctor is there helping Axel.
It's kind of funny that the entire opening act of episode starts with, like, multiple people getting up from being knocked out or passed out or in hospitals and whatnot. Like, the whole team is on the ropes, basically.
Yeah. We do cut to a scene where Abel, the bald-headed guy, said he had to go do something, and it's going to involve getting an audience with the president. So he actually goes to meet the Madam President of the United States, and we see her, I guess, in the White House, kind of bedridden, and she's got, like sunglasses on in her bed, and he's talking to her about, like, something that he needs. He wants.
Yeah, she needs an executive order to raid the army office.
Yeah.
So that's what he needs from her.
I feel like, I'm not sure executive orders work that way, but, like, who the fuck knows, I guess, nowadays. So.
Well, also, how would Watanabe know that?
I mean, the man could do his research. He definitely does.
I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure he's not just guessing. But you know, I give him some margin of error if it's not quite exactly how it would work. So, yeah.
One thing too that when she takes off her sunglasses, you can see that she's got the sort of star field in her pupils. So, yeah, she said that she actually was one of the very first people to take Hopna, which is why it's affecting her.
That seems kind of weird. Like, why would the president, or even that? If it was, even if she wasn't president, but I don't know, you know,
I mean,
3 years ago,
she
whatever,
might be like senator or something. Like, if she was,
yeah, like, I'll see, it'd be some politician. Like, why would they be an early trial?
Well, I don't know if it was so much a trial thing. I took it more like she became one of the first people who could have access to it because of her like position.
I think she said something about a trial. I remember hearing the word trial.
Was it really trial? Okay, yeah, that is a little strange that she took it as a trial. I kind of thought she was just like, you know, elitist in that the sense that she had access to it before the general populace.
I mean, it
did.
Is true that like, you know, people of that high position stature would have access to like cutting edge medical treatments and whatnot. Like, right. We've seen that in real life. So like, if it was like already approved and this is, but it's like on the cutting edge, I could see her getting access to it before for other people. It would be weird though if we're still in the trial phase where we're still trying to figure out, it like, does this work? Is it safe? What are the side effects? So on and so forth. But regardless,
I think it's just worth mentioning too. I mean, this is obvious, but I just like to say it, is that like the real risk feels like it's real now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we've got actual multiple people. We're seeing people close to the story who are deeply affected by the risk of Hopna potentially killing them, including the president of the country. So that's interesting.
Yeah. So Elena's illness, which sort of was maybe hinting like, is this are these early effects of Hopna? Seems like that was just unrelated. That was just a fever. But this is clearly, you know, she's got the galaxy eyes or whatever you want to call it. Like, okay, this is a real person with stakes who is probably going to die. The president.
I don't think I picked up on the Alana thing not being Hopna. How did you come to that
conclusion? She's now seems to be better.
I think Lynn mentioned that Hopna-induced fevers act differently than the one that Alana's like. I think they don't get better. They like just continually get worse and worse if fevers that seem to be linked to Hopna, whereas Alana seems to be on the mend. So I think that's what Lynn said.
Right. That was I don't remember any specific dialogue, but it was just like, oh, she's already better. Where if it was the Hopna thing, I don't think you get better from that.
Okay.
So it was sort of a fake out. Like, oh no, she's starting to get sick. Is this the effects of Hopna? Like, no, she was just, I guess, sick. Although we know that she took Hopna, so she will eventually, if nothing is done,
well, yeah,
succumb to it.
Everyone almost. We do catch back up with the Elizabeth character, who is Abel's colleague, and she brings with her to the barbershop that other hacker, Dr. 909, and they're there to basically kind of continue to do internet research since Alana is decidedly out of the country. They are there to help.
It's like the bit where Dr. 909, or his name's like Donald McDonald or something, or something weird like that. He saw Leland and kind of started recognizing him. Was like, have I seen you before? And of course, Leland was dressed up as a girl at that club at, I think it was episode 4.
Oh, right.
Leland had to be like, and he kind of shudders. You
know, I don't know.
That's what that was about. Okay. I kind of forgot. That was pretty good. And then he's basically there as a kind of work release because he's obviously doing time right now.
I think
now.
They want to reduce the sentence if he cooperates.
Right. Alana apparently survived something very traumatic when she was a child. Apparently, many people died around her, and she was one of the only survivors. And that's kind of something she says, but doesn't elaborate on in this episode.
Also, kind of similarly, when Doug is in that like army hospital, because he's like captured, but he's in like a med hospital or something. He mentions something like, "Wow, it's been a long time. I've been in the hospital ever since the incident."
Yeah.
Like, wait, what incident? Like, what's he referring to? Is something we know about or no? I don't think so.
Was it the incident?
I didn't know what he meant.
Was it the incident at the airport where the Hopna prototype was released? Because a lot of people seem to be getting
linked. Was he there?
I don't recall them showing he was there, but he might say he was now or something.
Because that was only Skinner was there, right?
No, because Chris was there too, remember?
Oh, right.
So yes. I'm just thinking it might be the fact that, like, a lot of people from the team just happen to be there. Narrowly or something. I'm not sure, but...
Maybe he was meeting Skinner there because he was working at a university at the time, so not sure.
I think Axel also talked about his memories being weird. Maybe we're going to have some sort of Final Fantasy VIII thing going on in episode 13 here where they all remember something like, oh, we were all in this other event over here.
Yeah, so well, things definitely... are definitely coming together in this episode particularly. Another connection we learn about is that Lynn, aka Popcorn Wizard, actually has a direct connection to Skinner herself. She was one of the residents of the islands that were sunk under the rising seas, and that when Skinner bought out the island, she was one of the people that was kind of saved by that. And she also is one of those people who's stricken with that that condition where she doesn't feel pain. So I didn't expect that. I thought she was just some random hacker, but she actually has a direct connection to Skinner as well.
Yeah, and she even says to Alana, basically, I have permission to let anyone know who finds me. I'll give them the location of Skinner. And that's basically how they figure out.
I mean, I think that's good to bring her in like that, just tie her more strongly to the narrative, because obviously he's now a reoccurring character and whatnot. I feel like, again, I need to rewatch earlier episodes, but I feel like I saw someone mention that she actually showed up or was teased earlier in the series before she showed up in episode 5. So I have to double check that that's true. But if so, that wouldn't be surprising, given like she is connected to all this.
We'll have a similar connection to make at the end of this discussion here, this episode, but we'll continue on right now chronologically. So we do learn that I think it's from Axel that the Hundun is a Chinese legend. And that the necklace that he wears, the one with the wing, it's something that he got while he was in prison. And it was something he uses to remember his dead friends who died from Hopna. So, again, not really sure what the whole Hundun thing is. We probably will learn that in the final episode. But they continue to give us little bits and pieces about that being somewhat important. We get a commercial break. And when we come back, this is when we learn that... this is the scene, I guess, that I kind of alluded to earlier, that Abel talks to the president and says he wants the NSA to raid INSCOM, which is the army. The president agrees. We then learn from, I forget what character tells us this, but we learn that Lazarus had two objectives. They have the objective to find Skinner, but they also had a second objective, and that is to expose INSCOM as a threat.
That might be related to what Skinner is actually trying to get at in some weird way. Who knows?
Possibly, yeah. It seemed almost like completely separate. Like maybe that's an Abel's exclusive goal. You know what I mean? I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's coming with the plot line with like Schneider and Hayes and whatnot, their machinations. And of course, as you said, tying back to... experiments are done to Abel and his cellmates and whatnot. So,
yeah. So we do learn that Skinner is in fact in Babylonia City based on his heart monitor readings. And we know where, and we'll talk about that in a second. Hayes is killed by the bad guy.
First one is Schneider, right? Isn't it Schneider?
Yes.
I forget the guy's name.
Yeah. It wasn't shown. But, like, you hear, like, a scuffle and a gunshot, and he's kind of acting like he was a third party to what happened, but he was the only person there.
Well, we mentioned that they were having a conversation about how it's fucked up, an assassin called into them and talked with them, and basically Hayes was chewing them out and then basically told Schneider. I don't think it was like, oh, we're going to come clean, but he was just telling Schneider that he was in deep shit or something, basically, because the assassination attempt failed and obviously made the even news, which is bad for assassin. I think so. That corn Hayes was not Hayes, excuse me. Schneider was like, all right, time to do a coup of sorts. And so that's when he killed Hayes.
It's funny. A couple of our criticisms were both addressed in this episode. One was what you said last time about the explosions and like making a big scene. They actually addressed that. And then the other thing they address is what you said, Seda, about this army guy. Like, why is he going along with this? And they kind of address that here where he's like, he doesn't like this.
Yeah. And basically the Schneider the other guy, the politician, is actually, or I don't know if he's a politician, but he's the one like, okay, this is a secret that's starting to leak out. We got to put some lids on it, which involves killing this guy. So,
yeah.
Was it earlier or later in the episode that we revealed the assassin had multiple personalities and that the assassin was actually the same guy who was eating steak in that previous episode?
It was in this episode they discuss it, and we kind of gotten hints of it, but it, yeah, something I didn't include in my notes here is during the hacking, when Elizabeth and Dr. 909 are trying to find out who the assassin is, they put together that HQ, his handler, is actually the same person as Soryu, and that this guy has multiple personality disorder. So, I mean, I knew that he had like mental problems, but I didn't realize he literally had associative disorder. So he doesn't even know what he's doing sometimes. So while the bad guy, the Hayes guy, when Hayes gets killed by the main bad guy, and all that's going on, at the same time, Doug has been trying to secretly escape this sort of hospital. He's in some kind of military hospital.
Yeah, it's like the army hospital, because he got captured from those other dudes that were chasing Alana. But you know, they were, he was in the hospital, like they obviously weren't going there for a moment, they weren't going to let him die, but then later they're like, well, time to kill this guy.
Yeah,
and they try to kill him.
He pulls the whole like, oh, the, you know, the pillows under the sheet trick where they think he's in the bed, but he's not there. And I'm assuming, and then, I mean, I don't have to assume, it's clear that this is like some hospital in Pakistan, because he's still in Pakistan.
Right, of course.
He didn't go anywhere. But yeah, we kind of see him, he's like hiding in the kind of nearby, trying to escape, and he's standing on top of one of those beds, and then suddenly, to his surprise, the bed just starts moving and going at great speed down a hallway, and we learn that it's actually Alana Lynn.
I think it was Popcorn Wizard.
Was it Popcorn Wizard? Okay. She had like hacked the remote control for this automated bed, and it's like ushering him out of the hospital.
I don't know if this would actually work this well, but sure, why not?
Yeah, I can understand those being like AI driven beds. I get that. Like, I don't know how
you run into a door.
Right. Like, how does she not? Does she have cameras?
Since she hacked into the cameras in the hospital, right? Like, they're like
every. Yeah, that must be it.
Corner of a hospital should have
a good thing. He didn't have to go up or down any stairs.
Yeah. Well, it could be as simple. I mean, like, if I really wanted to take it really far, I could go. It could be as simple as her telling the bed to go from position A to position B at high speed. And because it has some form of artificial intelligence in it, it has the ability to, like a self-driving car, kind of like dodge and weave and stuff. So I'll give it the benefit of the doubt.
He also be on the first floor. Like, you know, he doesn't.
Yeah, that's what I said. Lucky that he didn't have to go over any stairs.
Right. Yeah. Could have been really bad for him. But that was a kind of fun scene. He says he doesn't even know what's going on. He's getting saved there. And then I think they just sort of run into him out at the front there. They're there.
Well, they drove up to the hospital. So like they're waiting for him. They directed him to them.
And he hasn't ever seen Popcorn Wizard before. And he's like, who's this?
Yeah. And then this is the moment. This is the big moment that everyone in the thread kind of went like, oh my gosh. Which is they do end up discovering exactly where Skinner is. They pinpoint his signal all the way down to the homeless center from episode 2, the one where most of us who were watching the show recognized a character in the background who looked just like Skinner with sunglasses on, and we're all like, is that him?
I think it was episode 3. To be fair, Skinner looks kind of like your average, you know, fair-skinned middle-aged guy. Like, there are lots of people in the world who look like Skinner. Like, this series has pretty grounded designs. There's no, like, crazy anime hair or something. So, like, he just looks like a normal middle-aged dude. So I can definitely buy that a lot of people in the world who kind of look like him. And also, like, as we were discussing the thread back then, we're like, is that Skinner? Nah, that can't possibly be Skinner. There's no way. Like,
I thought maybe that's what they wanted you to think.
Oh,
that's exactly right. I thought there was only two outcomes to this. One, it was a red herring. Or two, it's a tease. It's like a Easter egg to look for later.
This was foreshadowing, obviously, but like it's pretty natural to be in a circumstance where like you're looking for someone, and you may be finding them, but they're in such a place you don't expect them to be. You're like,
oh no, I don't fault I don't fault Doug for not recognizing him. I get that. We as the audience are more observant than him in that sense. I mean, in that moment, I get that. But it's just, I just think it's really funny that we a lot of people who watch the show were like, he's right there. And it turned out it was him. So
okay, yeah, that's totally fair. Yeah, I think that is funny. I'll just try and say, like, I think it's not unreasonable that the actual main characters wouldn't have noticed. They weren't being idiots. I can buy if they didn't notice that. So.
Yeah. I mean, he is literally standing 3 feet from him in this shot. However, Doug is not talking to him. He's talking to someone else. So I guess it's possible. Yeah, I'll give him the benefit. I like a good like little Easter egg like that. So I'm okay with it. And then the final thing in the episode is that Doug and Alana basically are going to hitch a ride on that. Whatever they call it, the hypercube or the hyper something. To get back to the U.S. quickly so that all of our team can be together in the final episode, basically.
I think he'd arranged it, like, I guess he had connections or something, Doug, is my understanding. So that's how he was able to arrange it, get a private, well, it was a public venue, but it wasn't open to the public. So he just was able to get on there.
Yeah, it was, they got shut down because of Hopna, the Hopna crisis, basically, the hyper line or whatever it's called. Never got opened. It was they were wanting to open it, but it didn't get opened. And so they were like eager to be like, hey, you want to use our line? It's not being used.
Right. So, I do want to also mention that like Doug and Alana hitch a ride, but Popcorn Wizard who was with them or Lynn actually decides to stay by and just says, you know, Godspeed, you know, if you need me, call me, but I'm gonna stick in Pakistan. So like, you know, the team was just back to those core members of the Lazarus crew. Well, I guess one more thing I'll say, just this doesn't really matter at all. But like, I know Alana is kind of short. She's probably maybe around 5 foot, maybe 5 foot.
Oh, yeah.
Like, when Popper Whisper was like kind of like hugging her and like giving her the pep talk and whatnot, they were right next to each other. And I'm looking and I'm saying to myself, is Popper Whisper like 6 feet tall? Like, she's like,
she's gigantic. Yeah, she must be. I noticed that too. I think it's a combination of Alana being short and Popcorn Wizard being very tall because she was towering over her.
Yeah, it was like a good foot at least or something. So, I mean, not a problem. At least, tall women, of course. But I was like, oh, wow, she is a big girl.
Yeah, I didn't think I noticed it until that moment either because they were hanging out in her van for most of the episode. And I didn't really notice it then. But yeah, in that shot, it's like, wow, she's really tall. And again, Alana, not very tall. So
there's one other thing in this episode that some people might have put focus on. Chris kisses Axel.
Oh, that was such nothing thing. That was just like, I don't know, I see people over being like, oh my God, they didn't set up romance. How dare it's
not. I think that's very anime brain to me, where it's like so binary, where it's like, are they a couple or are they not a couple? Like, well, they already established that Chris had like a lover.
Yeah.
A couple episodes ago. They were playing piano together. That's what lovers do. And I don't know, Axel saved her from an exploding oil rig.
Yeah,
I don't know. I feel like a kiss, it may not be romantic at all. It might be a little romantic. It might just be, hey, we have a day left to live. Everything is, emotions are heightened. Everything is confusing right now. I'm just going to kiss you.
So I completely agree with you, Sid. I feel like people kind of blew that out of proportion. I saw that as being, there's a million reasons she could have done it. And the way she did it was so offhanded because she just sort of like kisses him and then doesn't even say anything. She just says goodbye and walks away with. It's like, yeah, I didn't take that as like she hasn't fallen head over heels. I mean, maybe she likes him, but like, I don't know. I don't think it's a big deal. People out there who be like, oh, this is a forced romance. I'm like, I didn't take it like that at all.
Get that take. No, it's just like two adults just being, it's an interaction. She's just being cute and thankful and just walking away. Like she's not, there's no sparks there because the show's not trying to make sparks.
Exactly. And I think that's who she is too. That's very appropriate for her character to act in that way.
And also, I just think like literally days ago, she was on an oil rig that was exploding, reunited with a lost lover who was killed in front of her and saved by Axel. Like her emotions are like, can you even imagine? I can't. So it's going to, like, I don't take it as a romance. I just take it as a, you know, end of the world. Emotions are tangled up all over the place. It's a kiss in return for having her life be spared, even if maybe for just a few days. Who knows? But I didn't take it as romantic at all.
Right. Yeah. They even say it's like, this could be the last time we see each other. Is there, I don't want to leave with any regrets, basically. That's basically it. So
it kind of made me think of like, this isn't exactly the same, but it kind of made me think of the kiss in Gurren Lagann between Yoko and, that other guy.
Oh, I forget his name. Right before think, right?
He like,
the blonde haired guy?
Not.
Oh, the blonde haired guy. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't think of that as, necessarily a romance. It was more just like key to the moment, last regret, like let me just do this right now because this is the last chance I'll get type of thing. And maybe she's thinking similarly, think it's very anime brain to be like, if they kiss they're a couple, if they don't kiss they're not a couple. It's like, no, come on.
I think like the show's kind of like actually pretty mature about it, and I think a lot of other people not being mature about it in a weird way. Like usually it's anime, it's when you see like the show's too anime or whatever. Like I feel like it's actually an inverse scenario kind of.
Ketan was gonna die in that moment. And it's like it wasn't romantic. It was just like it was a kind of like familial love. It was just sort of like
it was like this is the last chance I'll ever have of a possibility that may or may not have ever happened, but I'll never know now.
And also, like a kind of encouragement or like an appreciation for the sacrifice he's about to make.
Right.
So I agree completely. It's very similar in that regard. We all know who Yoko's heart belongs to.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Any other things about the penultimate episode here before we move on?
I'm excited to see how things conclude. Cross my fingers they land the plane. But I am... I think my general opinion of the show has improved, and like I'm just again hoping to land a plane, but I'm liking where things are generally headed. Like maybe the assassin plot was kind of a maybe last minute kind of thing, but they could wrap it up in a satisfactory way. I think there's definitely a chance in time. And the other thing I will say is that I know there's been a lot of criticism, or at least I've seen it out there, that maybe the show hasn't done a good enough job of making the Lazarus team feel like a cohesive unit of friends and colleagues and whatnot, and I kind of disagree. I think at the very beginning of the show it was very true. They're kind of just like randos kind of weirdly stuck together. And obviously I think more episodes would have been better if this was more paced akin to maybe a Cowboy Bebop or something of the sort, but I do feel like there is an increasing sense of camaraderie amongst the group. I feel like there is development in that regard. Like I think other shows have certainly done it better. I think the show has become itself better about making that team dynamic work, and think that it's in the short runtime it has to its credit.
I kind of thought this about two episodes ago, but I'm with you even more so now. All right. Well, let's move on to Dragon Ball Daima. Daima Episode 2, Glorio. So we learn at the very beginning of the episode that, to his surprise, the bad guy is not going to get three wishes. He's only going to get the one.
What's his name again?
Goma.
King Goma, yeah.
Just think Zelda spider guy. Okay.
Yeah. There's a kind of funny line or confusing line from Shenron, and he's like, I only do that for my regulars.
Yes, he even says my regulars. And he's like, goodbye.
I thought it was pretty straightforward and very Toriyama humorous.
Well, it's maybe confusing where it's in the sense of like, oh, I didn't realize Shenron like picked favorites.
Yeah.
Like you get a trial wish the first time, only one. I would kind of just assume that Shenron worked more rigidly, where it was just like, everyone gets three wishes no matter what. But we're learning things about not only are there dark and light magic Dragon Balls or dragons, but also he just has personal whims.
Yeah, I kind of like too that's something about Daima that I'm, even though we're only in episode two, that I'm enjoying. Is that there is this lore stuff that's happening, like we talked about last time about the Namekians and their original origins and stuff. And it's like, if this show wasn't by Akira Toriyama, I probably would have been like, But because he's involved and came up with the story for this, I'm like, this is cool. This is cool that we're learning these things about this world. We learn more in this than we ever learned about in Super about the way the world works, I think.
Already. I don't know. I mean, I will say Daima does do a good bit of lore building. Of course, because it's Toriyama, he can retcon whatever he wants. But to say Super doesn't, like, I mean, Super introduced the multiple universes, the gods, God Key. Like,
yeah, that's true.
Super added a lot. But Daima does. Right.
I just don't remember it as much, I guess. Yeah. Well, anyway, Goma and his crew kidnap Dende because they learn they can't make another wish. So they decide to take Dende with them as both preventing any more wishes from being made, and as just to kidnap them, literally.
And they Goma asks Neva, like, hey, just activate the Dragon Balls again. And they don't explain it necessarily, but Neva just says it was harder than it looked. Like,
yeah,
implying, or I don't know. I don't remember if that's exactly what he said, but it was something like that.
No, that is what he said. Yeah.
Implying that he can't do it again, at least not right away.
Right.
You can't just get free wishes every, you know, minute. So
we cut back to the party. Everyone's reacting to being turned into children. There's a funny moment where Mr. Satan walks up to a couple people and they're like, who are you? I don't recognize you.
Goten and Trunks are babies, but apparently can, like, babble speak to each other and understand each other.
At first, I thought this was just a gag, but then they kind of elaborate a little bit on later in the episode about this, or maybe I read this on the forum. I can't remember. But basically, they all have their adult minds. Everyone's their adult self. It's just that these two characters can't physically speak to each other.
Right. You see of Goku, Vegeta, Bulma, and everyone, they're adults and they're in their bodies and brains that are still adults. It's just their bodies have changed here.
So Goten and Trunks are 9 years old, but they're babies.
Yeah, it's like because they're babies, they can't form words with their mouths and they can't walk straight. But they're in their heads are like, now, I don't know if they were talking to each other. Were they talking to each other?
Well, the dub actually gave them lines. It was something like, Trunks, you're a baby. Like, yeah, you too, Goten.
Oh, did they say it? Okay, I don't know.
I don't remember the effect, but to me, it implied they were, like, babbling to each other, like baby speak, but somehow understood each other.
Oh, okay.
That was the way I understood it.
That's a little cheekier. Yeah, okay, that's fine, whatever. Who cares? It's a joke anyway.
Yeah, exactly. It's whatever. But it would make sense that they think like 9-year-olds or whatever. Yeah. So
everybody goes to the watchtower or whatever it's called. I always forget the name of that place, the lookout. Mr. Popo's there and he explains, these bad people came and they stole Dende and there was another Namekian here and his name was Neva, and Piccolo's like, oh, Neva.
Now how does Piccolo know Neva?
Well, he says that Neva's a legend.
Yeah, from legend.
Well, like, but he must have gotten it from, like, I don't know, the nail inside his head or Kami inside his head, I guess. Well,
oh, I see what you mean.
Because he was born on Earth from Piccolo and then split into Kami. Like, Piccolo's gone through a lot. Like, he was born from King Piccolo, split into Kami, fused with Nail, fused back with Kami.
That is Demon King Piccolo, thank you very much. Wink, wink, hint, hint.
Yes. Yeah, okay. I'm going to just chalk it up to Nail knew it somehow.
Yeah.
And then when he merged with Nail, he kind of knows all the lore or legends that Nail.
Have been legends passed down on planet Namek about the great master Neva who created Dragon Balls. Yeah, I'm sure. But yeah, that is kind of funny. I didn't even think about that.
Also, I'm just kind of, it's a lot of this could have been prevented had the Goma and his lackeys just taken Popo also. Like if they would have taken Popo,
yeah.
I guess the other guy would have probably still shown up. Wait.
No, isn't the plan to lure them into the demon realm?
No, this is a thing. The plan is they're afraid that if Goku and his friends ever invaded demon world, they kick all their asses. So to preemptively prevent that, they turn into children, but by doing so to give Goku and his pals incentive to go to
demon world. But then why steal Dende?
To get Dragon Balls back, because they can't.
Oh,
they
to prevent can't, Dragon Balls actually, from coming back. Okay. Yeah.
Well, they can't get to the demon Dragon Balls either.
But it's the same thing that Croc just said though. It gives them even more incentive to chase after them though.
Right. Exactly. But also, if they didn't, I'm just saying, the bad guys here should have taken Popo with them or done something with them, because Popo is just going to blab, hey, all this stuff happened, and they're from the demon world. Like, he's just giving them away.
I mean, I think they're thinking is that as kids, the Earthlings are too helpless to do anything about it. They're wrong, but that's what
and also Gloria would have showed up anyway. So
even before that though, Supreme Kai comes up with his idea. It's like, okay, now we know what happened. We know that King Goma is taking Dende and blah blah blah.
And my younger brother.
Yeah. My younger brother is involved. And so he's like, all right, well, we need to go get my ship. He goes oh, by the way, there's a running gag this whole episode where Bulma and other characters just keep asking that one guy to just teleport and get things for him. Supreme Kai's like assistant.
Ito or whatever.
So he's like, he goes and he fetches the ship that Supreme Kai came in, like, I don't know, hundreds of years ago or something like that. And it doesn't fly. But then, of course, we have Bulma, and it's like, Bulma, yeah, I can fix it. Just let me take a look at it. And while this is going on, we kind of learn that not only did their bodies change, but they've kind of had to, the Z fighters have kind of forgotten how to do their thing. Like, they don't know how to fly and balance themselves. They're not able to throw punches correctly, and they're kind of dealing with that.
And Goku is like, well, let me get my power pole, because I'm better at fighting with that when I'm a kid.
Yeah.
So he goes, gets his power pole. Also, just a quick thing. There was just a quick shot in this episode when all the characters were at like a table, and there was just it was a very quick shot of this episode just showing their feet at the table, and I just thought that was kind of nice to show that they're all like tiny now, and their feet are hanging way off the ground because they're all tiny. I just thought that was kind of cute. Like, yeah, and they're practically adults. They're speaking like adults. They're the characters we all know, but they're tiny little kids at this table, and I just like this shot of their feet.
And Goku's in his element because he always acts like a child, even as an adult. So this is like not different for him anyway. This goes without saying maybe, but I'll say it quickly, is that like him getting his power pole back, this feels like the goal that Toriyama had from the start. Like, he wanted to do another show where we got the original Goku back from Dragon Ball.
Oh, for sure.
So that's like...
For sure.
He's got the pullback. He's like, we're going full on retro here, which is kind of neat.
Mission accomplished.
Goku has a plan to go train. So he's going to go and try to like get better at doing his stuff while Bulma's fixing the ship.
They have to spend 10 days just getting ready.
It's actually Korin who knows where the Goku's power pole is. He tells them that Master Roshi has it. There's some fun bits in this show, in this episode as well, where we see Master Roshi as a grade school kid, and he's living it up because he thinks it's great to be young again. By the way, Korin in this episode, also voiced by Christopher Sabat. It's just kind of neat because all the characters now have new voice actors as children. In the credits, it says like,
I think they brought back classic ones too. Like, isn't the Goku playing child Goku now? Then she played him in the
maybe,
past.
Yeah, it was the original child Goku and also the original Gohan.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Before Colin Klinkenbeard did it in like the redub. So
gotcha.
So that's kind of a nostalgic thing. That's kind of nice.
In the credits, they refer to the voice actors as like Goku Mini. And Trunks Mini, or whatever.
That's how the characters are referred to, like, officially.
Okay.
I think in one of the Dragon Ball video games, Dragon Ball Z Kakarot, they added Daima content. And when you play as this version of Goku, it's literally called Goku Mini. Like, that's just what he is.
Goku Mini.
I guess it's a way to differentiate that this is the Goku from the Daima anime.
Right. Yeah, so, that makes sense.
Right, because like child Goku has the mind of a child.
Right.
Goku Mini has the mind of adult Goku, who even though we joke as is childlike, he's still an adult.
Exactly. Like. Yeah, and Bulma and everybody else. Yeah, that makes sense. So Goku goes to Master Roshi's island and gets the power pole back because Master Roshi was just using the power pole to hang up his laundry. That's when another ship suddenly appears at the lookout and everybody's like, oh no, who is this? Are these the bad guys? And then out pops this new character, this very tall-looking demon guy named Glorio. And he says he is there to recruit Goku in order to defeat Goma, because Goma is an evil Majin. Now, they talk about Goma being a Majin. Is Glorio a Majin, you think?
Majin is a generic term for, like, demon kin, basically.
Okay. So most demons are Majins, I guess.
Yeah, I think they said a few exceptions, but, like, generally, if you're a resident from of demon world and you have those pointy ears, I think Majin is the generic term. I believe that's how they phrase it.
I don't know the specific... I don't speak Japanese. I don't know the specific nuances, but I know, like, Majin just generally can mean, like, demon. But I also know that, like, Oni can mean demon, and I'm sure there's different, like, you know, nuances there. But yeah, I just take in Dragon Ball to mean, like, yeah, demon kin of some sort from the demon.
I mean, I suspect it might have been, like, because during the Buu saga, you had Majin Buu, you had Majin Vegeta, kind of those terms. So I think there might have been some inclination that it was more, like, it was still had that kind of demon etymology, but may have been a thought it was kind of more narrow focus. But I think here to expand the term out more broad in what he can mean.
And like you said a moment ago, like, you know, there was that nice scene where they kind of, somebody just straight up asking, it's like, so is everyone with pointed ear from the demon realm? And that's when Glorio's like, well, not everyone, but, or maybe it was one of the other Kai characters, but they were like, no, not everyone, but for the most part, yeah, which is kind of neat, again, like I said. Anyway, Goku's like, yeah, let's go. Ooh, adventure in another dimension. Let's go. I'm all for it. And so he's going to go with Glorio. And then the Saprikai wants to go as well because his brother's involved.
Vegeta's other people, like, let me go.
Yeah, Vegeta's like, I'm going too. Whoever did this to me is going to pay. And then he's like, no, nobody. My shuttle will only fit two people. And he's like, but we're kids. And he's like, well, okay, we'll fit, you know, three.
No, I think he just says my shuttle fits three people, and Vegeta retorts, three adults. Well, you can fit another kid in there, and he's like, no, it can't.
And then so they take off, and it's going to be Goku, Glorio, and Supreme Kai who arrive there first, and the rest of them are going to have to arrive once Bulma finished repairing the ship. Yeah. So
that's actually a good point. That maybe that's why they didn't take Mr. Popo, because they didn't have enough.
Oh, room. You know what? That's a good point. Yeah, maybe they couldn't fit him. I kind of took it that they just didn't care, but I like that idea.
I think that's probably more likely, but it would be Toriyama Humiro to be like, that would be the smart thing to do to take Mr. Popo with us, but we don't have room in the ship. Can't do it.
Yeah, there were technically four people when they left, because, I mean, if you count Dende, even though he's just like a tiny baby. But there was a scene in the first episode where the three of them were in that pod, and they were making a point about, like, being really cramped in there. So, yeah, makes sense. Okay, overall, pretty good episode. A lot of just sort of setting things up in this episode, but I thought the production values continue to remain pretty high. It looks great, and it's fun seeing these characters do their thing. It was a lot slower than the first episode, pacing-wise, but all right, overall. What are your thoughts, Croc?
Daima's pretty sweet. Like,
well, I just meant this episode. Just, I know you've seen the whole thing. What did you think of this episode?
This episode, I thought, like, it set the path up for, as you said, reestablishing this is, we have retro vibes, we got retro Goku, we have retro weapon. I think it set out a job to do, like, set the driving narrative, give you the whole retro feel, show all the cast young again, kind of revisiting the glory days a little bit. I thought it basically succeeded at what it set out to do.
Yeah, it's pretty decent. What did you think, Seda?
I felt this episode in terms of setting up the adventure was a good one for that.
Yeah. I guess they didn't really talk about the three Dragon Balls yet. Like, that's not on their agenda at this point.
Yeah, they may not even know they exist, but I'm sure they'll learn about it.
I just wanted to, I'm kind of saying that out loud as I'm thinking aloud, because we talked last episode, like, that's almost certainly going to be the goal, but, like, I don't think that's come up yet.
No, it hasn't.
Yeah, okay.
But I think you're absolutely right. They're going to get to the demon world and learn, oh, there's other Dragon Balls here? Well, we can use those to get back to our normal selves or whatever.
Okay, cool. Yeah, decent episode. Let's move on to Bleach. We'll be right back. Bleach Episode 6, The Fire. And I'll just start out by saying, this episode was fucking rad. Like, holy shit.
As they say, fire.
Oh my gosh.
Almost literally.
It was literally and figuratively amazing. Just
I like old guy fights.
They brought it.
Also, you should say this automatic that's nominated for Flavor Alerts, right?
Oh yeah, dude. This fight was it's going on the chart for sure. This was super compelling. And that's coming from someone who usually in shows like this kind of tunes out fights to a certain degree. I was super invested. I thought this was once we thought the fight was quote unquote over before the big twist, I was just like, how are they ever going to top this in this show? This fight was so good. It was like epic. Now I'm assuming this guy, the old guy, Yama, we've probably never seen him fight like this before, right?
No.
Okay. So this was probably like a big deal in the story, in the manga, when this happened, I guess.
We've seen him fight in the, remember the war in Karakura Town when Aizen came down with Harry Bell and then the first and second Espada, and you remember that whole bit from like the Ikumondo arc? Or am I speaking Greek?
Wait, say that again?
Regardless, in the Wekumondo arc, the second half of it, when Aizen brought his crew into the fake Karakura Town with the Espada.
Yes, I remember this.
And all those folks, do you remember?
Yes.
Okay, so Yamamoto was actually in that part of the arc, and he did fight, but like it's not, he didn't get to do Strut's stuff very much.
He didn't use his Bankai. Like, yeah, right.
He didn't get to use his Bankai. Aizen had like anti-Yamamoto measures in place, so he didn't really get to do much. So this is him really flexing. Yeah. We've seen him fight before, but this is him going all out.
So there was a little bit at the very beginning of this episode where it's revealed that while the Quincy War or whatever was like 1,000 years ago, the slaughter that's been hinted at actually only occurred 200 years ago.
Yeah.
So worth mentioning that, because I'm still a little confused about that, but they do mention that. So yeah, Yui Bawa and this Yamato old guy face off, and it's like I said, it's pretty much the whole episode, and it's just incredible. So Yama's Bankai, he has a bunch of names. He has like four versions of his Bankai that are related to the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, west. I wrote one of the names down, and after about the second one, I gave up. But they're like Zanka no Tachi, which is where basically he...
Oh, yeah. My God. Yeah. Like, even Japanese people have to be sweating when he tried to say
I agree.
That.
I mean, I felt bad for the voice actor in this episode because he's trying to say these ridiculously long Japanese names.
He earned his paycheck. Yeah. Hopefully you get
well. Yeah, he needs worker comp for that for sure. But yeah, anyway, his first form basically makes water evaporate. His sword suddenly becomes 15 million degrees. He can't be touched. In another version, he's able to summon the dead of the people that his enemy had slain. All this stuff's happening, and it looks amazing. The animation's amazing. Anyway, he ultimately gets Yui Bawa by slicing him, and we think the battle is over and he's used his Bankai, so now he's powering down.
First of all, I like how he specifies that the 15 million degrees is in Celsius.
Yes.
I don't know. It just kind of felt funny how they're like Celsius. Like everyone there would know what degree they normally use.
To be fair, Celsius would be default
pretty much anywhere except the U.S.
Use, yeah.
Right. So, like, I don't think he was, like, flexing. It's just like...
I mean, if I were to talk to any other American, what's the temperature outside? I would say it's 70 degrees. Or what do you set the oven at? You would say 300 or 400. You don't say 400 degrees Fahrenheit. Like,
yeah, but what's even funnier about that is that when you're dealing with 15 million, what difference does it freaking make?
Yeah, I think I actually just looked it up. That's about 27 million Fahrenheit.
I feel like I need to check. How hot is the sun? Because I feel like I need to check.
Might be that.
Yamamoto was making reference
to the sun. He did say something to the effect of like, it's like the surface of the sun or something during the fight.
I'm curious. Just
well, while you're looking that up, let me continue so we don't waste time. Like I said, the battle, we think the battle is over. Yui Bawa has been defeated. He's laying on the ground with a big slice missing out of him. And then, dun-dun-dun, up comes walking Yuibawa. He was somewhere else. He was hanging out with, of all people, Aizen.
Actually, he like exploded from the ground in like a grand light.
Yeah.
It was more of a badass entry than just walking.
I didn't remember the details of that. So, okay.
Oh, just as a side note, it says the part of the sun we call its surface, the photosphere, is relatively cool, 5,500 degrees Celsius. So it's probably hotter in the sun. Like, I forget my sun facts. Like, I this is all high school shit. I don't really remember right now, but at least it's way hotter than the surface of the sun. I would have to look up the.
Yeah, it sounds like if this was to be taken literally, everyone in the Soul Society should have evaporated instantly. So, but it's an anime. Probably. So we'll just give it a pass.
Sure. I mean, the fact that it's Bankai basically changed the weather is already pretty badass. Yeah. But yeah, I think everyone should have been like technically nuked or something. But, you know.
So whatever. There was a quick scene where Yuibawa goes down and talks to Aizen. That was, you know, one of his goals. And he wanted to basically recruit him. And he's like, you need to be working for me. And then Aizen's just kind of stubbornly being like, what? Why would I ever work for you? You know, I'm too cool for that. Something to that effect. And then they just sort of like, he just walks away. I don't know if anything more is going to happen with Aizen, but like, it's just interesting that he's still around.
I've heard through osmosis that he does stuff. So I'm sure he's going to come back into the picture somehow.
Yeah, this is not the last we've seen of Aizen. I will say he doesn't play a huge role moving forward, but we see him again.
Something about a chair?
Oh, chair sama. I'm sure you've heard of those memes, right?
I have not.
Don't go into any detail. I want to be surprised.
No, it makes sense like 20 episodes or more. Okay. But it's a while, but yeah.
Cool. Anyway, so yeah. So we, yeah, that and like everyone, Yama's like, whoa, what's going on? I thought I just killed you. And it's like, no, it was that one guy. It was that one Quincy guy that could make himself look like other people.
If we're keeping count, I think they mentioned Sternritter Y. So he was the Y letter, I think.
That sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yourself is the ability to basically clone another person, including their memories.
Right. And so he was able to fight and trick Yamamoto into using all of his energy to fight, and then willingly died. He's like, oh, I'll die. So a lot of the stuff that happened this episode, where you're seeing like Yuibaha like react emotionally to the people he's killed and stuff, and it's like that really wasn't him. It was this guy.
Well, like I said, this guy, the yourself ability allows him to mimic Yuibaha's memories, so that's why he's freeing those people. But it is true that Yuibaha is such a giant asshole that the fact he was expressing sympathy, I think, was more that Quincy's himself than Yuibaha. Like he was able to do that because he had Yuibaha's memories, but his reactions, I think, tell you the tale, because Yamamoto made a point of Yuibaha not caring about his minions. That'll come up later. But yeah, Yuibaha does not give a shit about his underlings. Yeah. We already saw that in the beginning.
That's already kind of been established. Also, this guy is also unbelievably loyal to the point of willing to sacrifice himself as well. So that's kind of like a double punch.
Right. Yeah.
So this guy's dead. And then, of course, this pissed off old man Yamamoto. And he's like, I'm going to take you down. I've got more strength than you know. And pulls out his Bankai, which, of course, leads directly to his Bankai getting stolen immediately, which was the plan all along. And then Yuibaha basically uses the Bankai to slice old man. And when the last shot is basically just him being sliced. So I'm curious. Don't say anything, Croc. I'm curious, but I have a feeling. I said like an episode ago, I thought he might die. He may die here. We'll see. I'm curious.
Yeah. You're talking about Yamamoto's fate?
He seems to have a significant chunk of himself gouged away.
Yeah, so I hypothesize that this old man may die in this arc, but I don't know, so we'll just see. But they definitely have leaving us on a cliffhanger that he may die here. So I'm going to say overall, this episode, like I said, it was fire. It was probably the coolest Bleach fight I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Spectacular from beginning to end, east, west, south, north, every fucking direction. Man was flexing. On the wrong guy, but he was flexing.
Yeah. It felt like that character just was in complete and utter dominating control of that fight. Like, you really felt this guy is powerful. Very cool. Okay. Let's go on to Blue Exorcist. Blue Exorcist Episode 6, A Wolf in Sheep's Clothing. Toto and Mamushi arrive at the original old temple, the Goma Hall, where I guess their clan originally started out as. They're looking for some kind of secret location that may be hidden there. Then we get back into the flashback, because remember, they're reading that letter from Tatsuma to Rin, which is basically Tatsuma's history, his flashback. Shiro, when he took tried to take the Koma sword, he passed out, but Tatsuma decided to heal him. And that's when Shiro learns that all of the other clans members are all suffering from the miasma. And they do something here in this scene that I was surprised by, where basically the monks in this, this area, all they're doing is just praying. Not like the kind of magic Blue Exorcist praying, but like just straight up normal human praying. And like Shiro so gets on them.
Thoughts and prayers won't cure illnesses,
yeah,
or prevent gunshots or anything of that sort.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. Shiro's like, it's like, this isn't going to heal anything. Here, go get this, go get this, go get that, go get this. I'll mix it up and I'll make a cure. And he does.
I was trying to make like political metal commentary there, but
I got it.
Go.
Anyway, yeah, he heals them, including Tatsuma's wife and unborn child.
Tatsuma wrote a lot on this little scroll that Yukio is reading.
Just tiny, tiny font.
It's like one page. French, excuse me. So I don't. It doesn't look like it would hold that much.
It was double-sided and he really, really tiny script.
Maybe, yeah. Or maybe you can condense a lot into cursive. I don't know. But yeah, this is a long story. It continues on. This kind of wins Tatsuma over on Shiro. But
Tatsuma's, I think his dad mentions, like, this guy is an exorcist and he comes from such and such. So they're like different, at odds philosophy with just the monks of the temple, who are more, I guess, praying, you know. So kind of exorcists are kind of magic themselves, I guess, but it's different than this sort of monk prayer sect.
Yes.
And the dad is like not at odds with this, with his methods. And even his the son, whose name I forget, Bone's dad, is like, but he healed them all. I'm getting the names mixed up. Bone's dad's dad is mad at Bone's dad.
Right. And it's like,
oh yeah, because yeah,
there's like a bit about like he tells Tatsuma is like, Shiro, he's not, you know, he's not following the rules. There's like a big deal about it being like the rules. And you can already tell at this point, like, Tatsuma is just like, screw the rules. This guy saved everyone's lives. Who cares? That's a big part of this episode, is we learn how much of like you kind of said this last episode, Seda, but like Shiro is very much a like free spirit and doesn't play by the rules.
But so right around this section in the episode, Tatsuma gives him the sword, the Koma sword. And I liked a line from Shiro, kind of sing-song, like, was, I'm going to kill a kid with this.
Yes.
And Tatsuma was like, no, I don't think you will. I think you're too good a person.
So matter-of-fact about it, too.
Yeah.
Gonna do some child murder.
Yeah. Well, I kind of take it. I mean, he's obviously talking about Rin, right?
Right. Yes.
So if it's the son of Satan, he probably isn't going to be that attached to worried about it, I guess. But yeah, I like that too, because he says it several times up to that point where he's like, I'm going to kill a kid. He says it so offhandedly. And
but specifically, I like the sing song version that he had.
Kill a kid.
But then Tatsuma right away was like, no, I don't think so. You're too good a person. I believe in you. Yeah. So
it was nice. It was a nice scene. And then, he kind of helps him escape. And that's when it's revealed. Then we kind of do a little quick flash forward before the story's over that there was a great secret that the Miyota clan is keeping, and we learn what that secret is, and it's that the impure king isn't destroyed or dead. They've actually captured it, and they keep it hidden under their temple. That's the secret.
Yeah, under one of the shrines. And that was the thing that Tatsuma basically could not reveal no matter what.
And it's a secret. Yeah, when we come back from the commercial break, we learn more about why that is. And one of the big reasons is they use this phoenix spirit called Karura. Karura, it's hard to say. Karura is a phoenix spirit. Karura? Huh?
I think whatever.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's Karura.
Karura.
Whatever. We're not, you
know, they refer to it as the vermilion bird or phoenix. So it's, we know all what a phoenix is. So basically that.
Isn't vermilion a type of green?
Vermilion is a... I think it's kind of a, what color is vermilion?
Is it type of red? I thought it
was reddish. I think it's a red orange.
Yeah, it is red.
Okay, maybe I was just wrong. Okay, I bet.
So, in order to capture and keep the impure king, you know, captured or whatever, and to keep it at bay, they make a pact with this phoenix, and then we learn that the phoenix itself. It's like, well, what do you want in return? And it's like, well, I live off the desires and secrecy of humans. And so as long as you continue to keep me a secret and never tell anyone what I'm doing for you, I will work with you. And this is why Tatsuma and the other elders have never told anyone why they're being so secretive and why they're not talking. It's a very kind of clunky thing, I think, under a certain extent. But that at least explains why this guy's not been telling everyone what he's doing.
But we also learn that this bird is basically the goal of the bad guys here.
Yes.
Before we get to that, I will say I agree with Cohen that though maybe it could have been handled better, maybe I do actually appreciate them being like, no, there's a reason everyone's acting like this. We're not writing this.
Yeah,
it all makes sense. Trust.
I do. Yeah,
trust the process.
I think I prefer this explanation to no explanation, where it would have just been like, "Why are you acting this way, you dummy?" No, at least he had a reason.
But there was also a point in this episode when they're kind of trying to like take care of this impure king who, spoilers, is starting to revive. The bird thing, the phoenix guy, even says like, "Well, the secrecy pact has been broken." But mentions like, I have another pact with Tatsuma, so I'm going to stick around for now.
Tatsuma mentions that to the bird.
Oh, I might have got it backwards.
One more, like something like that. Yeah,
I think the bird says something like, "I'll give you this one last moment," or something like that, where he's going to do.
I think I wrote down in my notes specifically, "Have another pact." Like they mentioned, you have another pact.
Oh, maybe I don't remember
some sort of agreement between Tatsuma and this bird. So like, even though the secrecy rule has now been broken because Jiro was there, right?
Because he instructed, I'm blanking the girl's name, but he instructed her to go tell everyone everything.
Yeah.
So that's what breaks the pact. What's her name again? Mamashii?
Mamashii, and Jiro is the other monk. But yeah, they kind of imply, well, there's some other agreement between this bird and the monk, which is why he sticks around for a bit. But I don't know, the bird... I don't know if they're going to meet the end of this bargain or not because the bird gets eaten.
Yeah.
Om nom nom. Fried chicken.
So that's when Todo and Mamushi show up. Well, I mean, they were there at that point, I guess. But anyway, they show up and they put the eyes back into the Impure King. Impure King starts to revive. Like you said, the Phoenix thing dies. Things are really, really, really bad.
Yeah, we're kind of jumping around plot points a little bit, but yeah, Todo reveals...
Yeah, I was going to say, we're definitely not going in any order whatsoever.
Well, Todo reveals that he's a Mamushii, he reveals to Mamushii that, like, yep, I'm a demon and I tricked you. And then soon after, basically, kind of reveals that this whole gambit, this whole plan was to get this clan, this sect, to reveal this vermilion bird and eat it.
Yeah.
Like, that was the plan.
Nice.
The king himself was more just a means to an end.
Exactly. The Impure King wasn't even their goal. It was just to get them to fight the Impure King, to use the Phoenix so that it could get captured. And they don't just capture it. Todo eats it. He eats the the thing.
But like, I did think, like, I had a hard time grasping earlier, previously, what exactly was the end game with the Impure King? Like, what exactly did he want? Maybe he had lied about something, I can't remember. But I had a hard time grasping what the end game was, that was. But this reveal, like, oh, actually, that was just my bank shot. It was my actual end game. I think it actually makes it a lot more interesting. Yeah. In terms of, like, what is this guy planning? What is he doing? Why is he acquiring power? You know.
Yeah, we still don't really know what his goal is. He just powered up.
He mentions that how he's like younger now.
He looks younger.
He mentions it, but I think he also says something about like it's like a side effect. Like that wasn't his goal. His goal wasn't to get younger, although they'll still take it.
No, his goals get more powerful, and you got younger as a
right. That's my point. That wasn't like you might think, oh, his goal is just youth. But no, that wasn't really his goal. That's just kind of a side effect.
Yeah, to the his goal was more power, Dante. Yeah. I need more power.
And so that's pretty much where the episode ends and the letter itself ends. And that's like the last of the thing. Because Tatsuma does appear to die in this moment. So, or wait. No, this was in the... No, well, he died already, I guess. Right?
He's dying, but we don't know. It's, you know, it's anime. Someone could swoop in at the last minute or something.
All right.
I mean, he got shivved through the throat. He's bleeding out. He's passing out. He looks like he's going to die. And I think that might make sense given the whole thing with Rin jumping in earlier to save Bong. Say this to your father. You may not know when you might next see him. He might die. Wink, wink, hint, hint. Yeah, so that if he dies,
it's possible.
I think that'd be set up,
but... It is possible that he's dead, though, because they gave him the letter. I don't know. I kind of took it as one of those situations where it's like, if, upon my death, give him this letter or something. But I don't know. We'll see. One last thing I want to say about this episode, and then I'll ask you guys, is that I did like how they've kind of like given the Mamushi character kind of a redeeming moment here. So it's not a big deal.
Well, I think. Wait, what do you mean? What do you mean redeeming moment?
Well, they make it perfectly clear here that she was duped. And that
she didn't betray them. She was tricked.
Yeah, she was tricked and she feels bad about it.
Well, I kind of hope she has a moment later in this season to redeem herself. Because right now she's basically in the point where like I screwed up and this is all my fault. And like
I believe
this lie. So I hope she gets a moment later in this season to, you know, redeem herself somehow, like make amends.
Right. I hope for that too. I just think I guess maybe redeeming moment isn't the right word. I should have said the show has made it clear to her that she is a good guy now. She's not going to remain an evil minion or whatever.
She's absolved basically of
and it was done through like the wisdom and the heroism of Tatsuma, you know, basically being trusting of her and helping her in that moment. So I like that. Anything else?
Oh, this is episode 6 out of 12, right?
Yeah, so we're halfway through the season. Yep.
Yep. Okay. Pretty decent episode. Let's move on to the final show of the block, One Piece. One Piece episode 734, To Be Free, Dressrosa's Delight.
Nothing happened in this episode.
Yes, exactly. My notes are super scant here because there's nothing to say. We spend literally 10 minutes waiting for Gyatso to say something.
Didn't that guy get stabbed in like the fucking heart or some shit? Like, what is he doing?
Maybe.
It's just... It's One Piece for you. If not flashback, you survive anything, basically.
So
I'm going to go out on a limb here and think and say that I'm going to doubt in the manga they had this whole moment where Gyatso couldn't bring himself to say who the winner was. Probably and they spent not. Like 10 minutes. Like, you could do it, Gyatso. I believe in you. You can say the name. You can do it. We believe in you. We'll do this for 10 minutes.
It was so excruciating waiting for it to happen. It was just like, come on. Anyway. And then the birdcage fades. Everyone falls over once it disappears. Like what I mean by that is that like everyone who was pushing on it, like suddenly it's gone and they just all kind of fall over.
Because they're pushing against nothing, so.
The one part about this episode that I kind of liked was Viola kind of breaks down crying, and it, like, out of all the characters in this arc, obviously there's other characters too, but she's the one who's kind of, like, been through all of it this whole time, from childhood to adulthood.
Yeah.
And, like, it's finally kind of over, and she just can't, you know, keep herself composed anymore. It's like, yeah, that's a very sensible reaction from her. To just start basically sobbing. Yeah.
Yeah. If there's one thing I would say about this episode is the crying. Everyone cries. Almost everyone cries in this episode.
Yeah. I just think Viola made the most sense to me.
I did. Well, I would say too, that, and then the final one as well, which is Kiros.
Kiros, yeah.
Kiros cries. And they kind of make a point about how, like, I don't know if they said this outside, but I thought it was kind of interesting to think about the fact that this is actually the first time Kiros has cried since he was a toy. Like when he was a toy, he couldn't cry, and now he actually has human tears and he can cry once.
Yes, tear ducts, my beautiful friend, I welcome you back.
Yes. And it's like, it's kind of nice, because like, and he does it kind of by himself when no one's around, so he can. And that's the other thing, this episode again, that kind of makes it like a really bad One Piece episode, is like every scene, every shot is when we cut to a character, we have to watch like several minutes of them, of their antics that happened during the arc. It's just recap upon recap upon recap. So it's everything we've seen before to fill time. So anyway, a lot of crying. It's what you said last week. It's like we have to spend a whole episode learning about the bird cage going away. That's it, literally what this was. And that's One Piece. Not a particularly good episode. I'd say it was pretty bad, actually.
When Viola cries, does she have to be careful not to accidentally turn her tears into missiles?
Yes.
I mean, I feel that's all, like, very conscious. Like, she has actively do that.
I'm joking.
I'm with you, Croc, but at the same time, I don't think he was really asking the question.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, well, let's talk about flavor alerts.
Flavor alert.
Potential award nominations.
So yeah, the Yamamoto versus Yui Baoha fight, that's going in best fight, because that was pretty great.
Yep.
I'm open to other suggestions on things. I got to look up how to spell Yui Baoha, because it's so stupid.
Can we just put in Yui Baoha as best villain? Like,
he's pretty bad. I agree. I like him. Yeah, he's pretty.
Like, obviously, he's got a lot left. I'm assuming a lot left. But at this point, he's gonna be there. Might as well just nominate him now.
Yep, I'm putting him in. He's already pulling his weight, as far as I'm concerned. Especially in this episode, where like he's so callously and like nonchalantly came back to just kill this guy. Like he was just like, you played into my hand so easily.
It's been my trap card, all according to Kaku, all the
trap card fully played here. It was really good.
I'm going to go ahead and nominate best performance by voice actor, Neil Kaplan, as Captain Yamamoto.
Okay.
Basically for this episode. Maybe, I don't know if we should nominate it quite yet, but Richard Epcar is the voice for Yui Baoha.
Okay.
And I'm sure he'll have more moments later. I mean, everyone, if you watched anime, dubbed anime, you know what Richard Epcar sounds like. So it's not like, I'm not saying he doesn't have any range, but like, yep, that's a Richard Epcar role. That's definitely him. But he's done a good job. Yeah. But I'm like, I don't know if I want to nominate Yui Baoha yet, or should we, he's going to be around for a while, I assume.
Let's wait a little bit longer. We've got one here. Now,
Yamamoto, like, I don't know if he might be gone.
Yeah, we'll see. I will tell you that, like, I like his voice a lot in this episode. Now, I mean, his performance is good, but it's just this, what Neil Kaplan brings to this voice, the way he sounds, is so unique and interesting. And every time he talks, it's interesting. It's fun to listen to. So I like him a lot.
He's also the voice of Madara in Naruto.
Oh, that makes sense.
Ooh, okay. Oh, yeah, Madara's good.
Yeah, it's a slightly different voice. Mm-hmm. You can tell it's the same guy, but it's not the exact same like intonation. So
it makes sense. I mean, Yamamoto is very serious, and Madara is kind of jokey sometimes. But yeah,
do we want to nominate Gyatso's speech as a worst moment?
Sure, go for it. It was pretty bad.
Our Gots and speech. Because, like, why did we take... It was, like, not even funny. It was just, like, annoying.
Yeah.
It was trying to be funny.
The whole announcement of the winner of the thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, we spend almost 20 minutes of him just not doing anything.
Yeah, that was maybe one of the more egregious toy fillers I can recall. So, yeah, that seems fine. Yeah.
What do we think of Yamamoto's Bankai?
For best ability?
Yeah.
Let's go for it.
Yeah, that'll go on there. Okay. That's a good pick.
Do you remember what it was called?
No, I'm just going to put in Bankai because I don't...
Yeah, come on.
I can look it up.
I don't think any of us were capable of pronouncing correctly.
So. Yeah, I can... Here it is. This means nothing to me. You ready? Yamamoto Gensurasai's Shinigunkuni's Bankai in Bleach is named Zanka no Tachi. Zanka no Tachi.
All I know is no means of.
I wouldn't be surprised if that's like a sword of fire or something.
Sword. Something really so Tachi is sword. Wait, what is it?
Zanka.
Zanka.
Zanka no Tachi. I'll put it in here.
Just mean like flame, sword of flame?
That's what I'm going to say. I wouldn't be surprised if it's just what it means. Like, I'm sure it says on the Bleach Wiki what the actual meaning of the sword name is, but I wouldn't be surprised. Is that the Bankai's name or just a sword?
Yeah, I guess no Tachi means sword of, and Zanka, I guess, is like the way that it's like the way that it's, I guess,
well, it actually means
translated is remnant flame, so it's like sword of remnant flame.
Yeah, like, okay, it has a lot of meanings. It could mean last flower and bloom and stuff like that as well, but the flame has got to be it.
But I mean, yeah.
Meaning fire, refer to embers. Yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah, Viz in a manga at some point actually translated as Blade of Ember, which, like, yep, that checks out.
Yeah, it's pretty good, yeah.
So,
I wish we had more voice actress performances. We only have one so far this year.
Well, Lazarus is almost over. Like, are there any performances in Lazarus that we think are, like, top-notch? And honestly, I can't, not one like obviously comes to mind for me.
No.
It's fine dub. Like, I've seen people like really lambast it, but I thought it was like fine, but I don't know if I would say any character was necessarily spectacular.
Right. Yeah. That's where I'm at.
It's actually something that came up, I want to say briefly, in the DeMarco interview. That's the reason they got Sentai for Lazarus was just basically the scheduling and availability worked out the most. That's often why they use Sentai, and that's why they've used them so frequently lately. They'd like to still work with Bang Zoom and NY Post, but that's why the end of Sentai for Lazarus. So
I'll tell you, I think the Lazarus dub has been very decent. Like, I'm not going to say it's blown me away, but I'm also going to say we used to have pretty harsh criticisms of Sentai dubs, and this show's kind of like, they're not all bad.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's definitely, for Sentai dub, I think it's on the higher end of quality. Of course, that was going to fall short of some other dubs, but like some people I've seen online being like, oh, the dub is trash, only listen Japanese, like, they're entitled to their opinion. Can't say I agree.
Like, it's not as good as Sentai's best dub is still Made in Abyss, what we've seen, right?
Oh, so. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I would say so.
All right, anything else before we close out the show as far as nominations here?
He's not there yet, and I don't know if he's going to survive through the end of the season or becomes a reoccurring character. But Toto might get there if he, you know, he's like
clear. Oh, for best villain.
Yeah, he's clear an upward trajectory. We'll see where he goes with it. Like, you know, but I would not nominate him now, but maybe in the future he gets there. I'll keep an eye.
Let's think about it, because you're right. I mean, like, kind of determines on what he does in these last six episodes, but I will say in this episode, he pretty much played everybody, so.
Yep.
All right. Well, let's close out the episode. That'll be it for episode 431. Thank you for being here, Seda.
Yeah, no problem.
And thanks for being here as well, Crocodile.
Pleasure as always.
And that'll be it for episode 431. We'll see you next week for episode 432. And until then, later. Later.